Mourners in Iran stage more ceremonies marking 40 days after the deaths of young people killed by security forces. As we'll hear from a VOA Persian journalist, some mourners are turning these sad occasions into celebrations of life.
And that's a very important and a new thing in Iran. It is really new tradition that they're starting to celebrating young kids who lost their lives because of some brutality.
Plus, women in Iran suffered a major setback to their rights with the 1979 Islamic Revolution. An Iranian-born former World Bank advisor tells us what happened after Ayatollah Khomeini seized power.
And very soon, even the intellectuals kind of went along with Khomeini and the rest and really pushed out women.
And later in the program, we'll look at the prospects of Iran and Saudi Arabia starting a high-level dialogue despite long-running tensions. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning, I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Crowds gathered Tuesday in ethnic Azeri parts of northwestern Iran to mark 40 days of mourning for young people whom activists say were killed by Iranian security forces cracking down on nationwide protests. In Tabriz, they mourned a 23-year-old medical student whose family said she was killed by gunfire from security agents. Authorities said she fell from a height. Mourners chanted "Death to the Dictator," a reference to Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. In Mahabad, residents mourned a young man named Kamal Ahmadpour and two other men killed in November. The crowds chanted "Kurd, Baloch, Azeri equal freedom," expressing a hope that Iranian ethnic minorities can achieve freedom through unity. Ali Sajadi of VOA's Persian service joined me in the studio to explain why these mourning ceremonies are turning into new protests.
Well, this is an Iranian tradition. When someone passes away, there are two important days after the passing. One is the seventh day, they get together to mourn, and the other one is the 40th day. The third one is on the annual anniversary of it. On the 40th day, usually they get together to remember the past one. But in this era and this time, the Iranians use it to show their protest. Maybe a little bit twist the ceremony and make it a protest, a new protest. That's very interesting. I believe this is the only way they can show what they think about the government, what they want from the government, and maybe from the international community as well, because the Iranian government is really brutal and they have no other way to show their sentiment, the way they think.
What are some of the most interesting protests that you've seen on these 40th memorial days?
Actually, it was about that 9-year-old kid, Kian Pirfalak, who got shot while he was on his parents' car.
And this was in the southern city of Izay in Khuzestan province.
Yes, in Khuzestan. The kid, there is some video left from that kid. It shows that he was so happy and so intelligent, actually fascinated with science especially. And it really catch the heart of many, many people. Still thinking about it makes me
I can imagine.
Uncomfortable.
Right.
On his 40th day, what was really catched my eyes was how people, instead of mourning, they danced and sing some happy songs remembering the kid. This is amazing.
Well, why would they do that?
Just to show that that's my take. I think they want to tell the government, the Iranian regime, that we can make it. We do not give up to your saddening situation. This is what the kids wanted, to be happy. We are happy. Something like that. It is really hard to explain it, or But that's how it happens. And I saw that in other 40th day of other kids that killed too. Instead of mourning, they are playing music in Kurdistan, in other areas of Iran, and basically like celebrating their life instead of doing mourning because they lost them. And that's a very important and a new thing in Iran. It is really new tradition that they are starting to celebrating young kids who lost their lives because of some brutality.
It is remarkable to see that when there's still so much suffering that they try to turn the negative into a positive. Yeah. One other development I wanted to ask you about. One of Iran's greatest football legends, Ali Dai, said the other day that his wife and daughter, who were on a plane from Tehran to Dubai to apparently have a vacation there, were actually stopped from traveling by having their plane taken down in Iran and then removed from the plane. And he was complaining about that. So what was going on here?
Well, Ali Dai is one of the players. He's a very strong man. And I really think he's on the right side of the history, as we say. He supported Iranian people on their demand. That's why the government, the Iranian regime, basically is getting revenge of him. He's a very successful businessman too. To sympathizing with the people, he closed down his business for so many days. Whenever the young kid said, close down the business, he was one of the few first did it.
And now it looks like the authorities actually
getting revenge.
Forced his businesses to close as well.
That's true, yes. And that was yesterday. And his reaction, Mr. Dai's reaction, was very interesting. He said, I'm still happy that they didn't take down the airplane by missiles. And he's referring to what happened that government did on purpose 3 years ago.
With the Ukrainian plane.
The Ukrainian plane. And killed, I think, 170-some, about 180 innocent people. So that's actually, that's how the Iranian people, including, it doesn't matter if they're rich or poor, they're really in this kind of situation that they don't know what government gonna do with their beloved people.
So they should be thankful that they weren't killed,
yes,
basically.
That's what he said.
Well, Ali Sajadi, managing editor in the VOA Persian service, thank you so much for coming back to Flashpoint Iran.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
A report published this month by Vienna-based advocacy group Women Without Borders explains how the ongoing struggle for women's rights in Iran actually originated in the late 19th century. It says women took an active role at the time in a movement to draft a new constitution, but they were disappointed when conservatives relegated them to a second-class status in the constitutions of 1906 and 1911. But as I learned when I spoke on the phone with the report's author, former senior World Bank advisor Nadere Chamlu, Iranian women later found a more receptive ear when the Pahlavi monarchs came to power.
As you know, the Pahlavi dynasty started in 1925, and it's credited for really starting the modernization of Iran. And women, the Pahlavi monarchs, Reza Shah first, and then, of course, Mohammad Reza Shah afterwards, they saw women's emancipation as part of that modernization. So in 1934, Reza Shah abolished the veil because the veil was not only symbolically keeping women out, but then, you know, much of the public sphere was not accessible to women. Women were allowed to enter universities and so on. And in 1963, Mohammad Reza Shah gave the right to vote to women and to be elected, so voting right and the possibility of being elected, and a number of women did gain seats in the parliament. In 1967, he instituted a very, I would say for its time, a very progressive family law. And so that was essentially, you know, the progress that women made. But most importantly, there was an affirmative effort to really push women forward. And I would say my generation and myself, even myself, benefited from that jump.
So how dramatic a shift for the status of women in Iran was the revolution, the Islamic Revolution of 1979? And how did women react to that change in their rights?
It was devastating, to be very brief about it. You see, those people who were kind of advocating for the revolution and, you know, they were at the forefront of the revolution were mostly intellectuals. And those intellectuals had been talking about democracy and, you know, inclusion and all of these nice words, human rights and so on. But of course, the revolution was then sort of like hijacked by the religious factions. And very soon, even the intellectuals kind of went along with Khomeini and the rest and really pushed out women or crowded out women. There are many, many stories about how, for instance, Bazargan, who was one of the, you know, leaders of the intellectual, let's say, faction, didn't want women to participate in the meetings and so on. So women really reacted very, you know, decisively. They had demonstrations. They tried to do everything possible in their hands to really show that the clock could not be turned back. But unfortunately, you know, the power was with the religious factions, with, you know, the intellectuals who had been co-opted by Khomeini to go along because power was important and they didn't want to lose power.
Well, if you fast forward, you know, more than 40 years, you have a new, much younger generation of Iranian women who are very involved in the current protests, and they don't have memory, obviously, of the rights that women once had in Iran and that were taken away. So how is it that these younger Iranian women have been such passionate advocates for greater rights, given their lack of memory of what happened before?
Well, I would say that actually there is a very strong memory of what was before. I mean, let's not forget, you know, those 50 years of really, you know, having the wind in your sails type of effort. I mean, you know, the sky was the limit, essentially, for women to do whatever they wanted to do. And suddenly you come to a very squeaking halt. Naturally, the women did remember. I mean, in every family, there were women who were educated, who held positions. And these women were, of course, pushed out. I mean, it's important to note to what great extent the government and the regime went to really push out women out of jobs and so on. So there was actually a great memory that that yes, women could do, women did have, women were women, you know, that memory was there. So these are the grandmothers or the great grandmothers of the generation that, you know, so from inside the families, these values and these attitudes continued to kind of germinate and to mushroom. I would say that exactly because of the memory that Iranian women had. And of course, also many of these women emigrated and, you know, they did very well outside Iran. And of course, you know, they had relations with those inside Iran. But Iranian, the modernity of Iranian families continued despite the efforts of the regime.
One feature of the life experience of these younger women who are now leading the protests is their relatively high degree of education compared to young men. How have the educational abilities of young Iranian women, you know, contributed and fed into their desire to push for change right now?
Well, let me first say that women across the world have outnumbered men. I mean, in most countries, I shouldn't say across the world. Even in the United States, there are more women that are going to college than men, even in the Arab world, even in everywhere. So Iranian women have also essentially followed that same trend. And part of the reason was that, you know, girls were essentially relegated to the home. It's not the same way as the Taliban or in Afghanistan. No, Iran has never been able to roll back the clock as much as the Taliban were able to do that in Afghanistan.
And why do you think that is?
Because of the fact of that memory of the 50-year memory, for men and for women, I have to say, that, you know, that was a cultural change that really grew roots and they were not able to literally uproot it. I mean, I could see that in my own family that there was no way that women were going to accept. So girls were, you know, were at home and they studied. And, you know, fortunately, university entrance is to a large extent, I shouldn't say exclusively, but to a large extent, meritorious in the sense that you have to pass an entrance exam, and on the basis of the entrance exam, you know, you can enter the university. So that was one important element. The other important element was that there was a big, vast spread of universities. So, you know, girls could go to universities even in their own cities or whatever. So that essentially also opened up opportunities.
Now, Iran's Islamist rulers obviously were not able to stop this move toward greater higher education for women. And now they see the result with many young people, young men and young women, protesting in schools, on the streets. Why do you think they allow this to happen, given that it seems to have come back to bite them, this kind of educational policy?
Well, they had no choice. They couldn't control it. I mean, they did try to control it. For instance, you know, initially, the share of women that outscored men was about 64%, 66%, and it was growing every year. Then they came and said, no, let's have at least a 40% quota for each sex. And then the remaining 20%, so 40% men, 40% women, and the remaining 20% would be allocated to whoever got the higher score. So in the end, it turned out that, you know, 60% of university students were women and 40%. So they tried. They tried to limit the access of women to universities. And then they tried, you know, certain fields were not accessible to women, certain types of, you know, degrees. You know, you could only study up to this level, but not beyond this level. So they tried. I'm not saying that, you know, it was all beyond their control. But even with those limitations that they put in place, they couldn't, in the end, push women back into the home.
Well, Nadire Chamlu, former senior advisor at the World Bank and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, speaking to us from Northern Virginia. Thanks so much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said he had a rare meeting with his Saudi counterpart, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud, on the sidelines of a regional conference last week in Jordan. The two regional rivals had begun a lower-level security dialogue through Iraqi mediators in Baghdad in April 2021, but it stalled a year later. Hamid Reza Azizi is a visiting fellow at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. I asked him on the phone why it matters if Iran and Saudi Arabia restart talks between diplomats or security officials.
First of all, the two sides do not have actual diplomatic relations, or formal, better to say, diplomatic relations since 2013, actually, when the Saudi diplomatic buildings in Iran were stormed by the hardliners. So in that sense, you know, especially on the Saudi side, for their foreign minister to get engaged in the talks would mean that, you know, they have already agreed to restoration of the diplomatic relations, which is not something that the Saudis want to happen at this moment before their conditions on different fronts are met. And on the other hand, another difference is that the very nature of differences and disputes actually between Iran and Saudi Arabia over the past few years has been security rather than diplomatic. So unless those, you know, issues are resolved by the kind of security officials of the two sides, it would be close to impossible to see actual kind of, you know, restoration of diplomatic relations at the level of foreign minister. And of course, then things like a reopening of the embassies, etc.
Well, can you tell our listeners what are the security issues that are most in dispute today between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
The most important issue for the Saudis, especially, of course, has been the war in Yemen. And the role of Iran, of course, in supporting both politically and financially, logistically, basically supporting the Houthis, which has caused kind of a lot of trouble for the Saudis, especially since 2018, that we witnessed basically how they are capable of harming the Saudis and also their allies like UAE in terms of the missile capabilities, drone capabilities, etc. So first of all, the Saudis want this support to stop. And also they expect Iran to show a kind of positive contribution, of course, to a peaceful settlement to the war in Yemen and the end of the war in Yemen. So this is something that the Iranians claim that, you know, they have no specific role in terms of kind of actual influence over the Houthis. And of course, you know, there's a broader scene of events throughout the region in which both Iran and Saudi accuse each other of not abiding by the other side's security concerns. For example, Iran accusing Saudi Arabia of instigating separatist sentiments in Iran, financially supporting, for example, kind of opposition groups here and there, basically all over the world. These kinds of things have been at the forefront of the security disagreements between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Well, what do you think Iran and Saudi Arabia believe they can realistically get from each other in terms of concessions?
As I said, for the Saudis, it is very important for Iran to stop, first, to stop their support for the Houthis, and second, basically convince them to an actual and lasting ceasefire and the political process in Yemen. So unless this issue has been agreed by the Iranians, I see no real prospect for the Saudis to come to terms with Iran. And on the Iranian side, what we've heard a lot, especially over the past 3 months since the start of public protest, is the Iranian officials accusing the Saudis basically of waging a media war against Iran and trying to influence public opinion in the country. So in that context, actually, they raise this issue as a precondition that the Saudi side should stop its support for the opposition media, Iranian opposition media, actually based out of the country. So these are basically the main demands that the two sides have from each other. And the realization of those demands, I think, would be a huge benefit for each side, because you know, if the situation in Yemen is settled down, then it would release a lot of financial and also political and military burden that the Saudis are, having right now. And also for Iran, at least the way that the Iranian leaders believe, it would make it easier for them to regain control over the situation domestically in the absence of the media war, as they interpret.
Well, how likely do you think it is that either of these two sides is going to get what they want from the other?
I think at the moment it's very difficult to see such a thing happening, a kind of concession, mutually acceptable concession, happening between Iran and Saudi Arabia, because especially the Saudis seem to be comfortable with the current situation, because Iran is under a lot of pressure, both domestically and internationally, at the domestic level because of the ongoing public protests, and at the international level, of course, given the fact that there's a kind of growing international consensus, as we can see, against the Islamic Republic because of its domestic repression, because of its support for Russia in the war in Ukraine, etc. So in that sense, the Saudis feel comfortable with waiting a little bit more so that they can maybe, get a better deal from the Iranians. And for the same reason, actually, also because the Iranian side sees itself having the, kind of weaker hand, it's less likely for them actually to go ahead with an actual agreement with the Saudis. So this is how I see the situation right now.
Well, Hamid Reza Azizi, visiting fellow at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin, thank you very much for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That's it for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin. Have a happy new year, and please join us next week for another Flashpoint Iran.